Okay. Well, it's great to see a lot of people out here today. Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. And as most of you know, philosophy comes from the Greek words meaning love of wisdom. So we are all about wisdom. We're a nonprofit organization designed to bring philosophy ideas and intellectual discussions to the DFW area. We are intrigued with questions such as, do our senses accurately describe reality? What makes wrong actions wrong? How should we live? And these are philosophical questions, and philosophy teaches the way in which we might begin to answer them, and we are all intrigued with those kinds of big picture questions. I'm Rob Olson, Dallas Philosophers Forum, and I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. All of our board members are volunteer workers, so we have David Drum, who is our treasurer. We have Skip Kilmore on the board, David Alkick on the board, and Ken Sauter. Ken, you want to raise your hand? He is our webmaster extraordinaire and AD extraordinaire guru. Are you an AD guru?
I wouldn't call myself that.
You wouldn't call yourself a guru? Okay, well, I would. So we're all volunteer workers, and we meet on the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. We sort of follow the traditional academic schedule. Do we have first-time visitors? We do. Okay, so how did you guys hear about us? I'm sorry? They're both pointing toward each other.
They told each other about it.
They told each other up. So how do you hear about it?
Okay,
so you introduced, and told them that how great we are, right? Okay, and we're all very intelligent, we're all above average, we're all intelligent, right? Extremely difficult. We're like the woolly god of philosophers, right? All the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the children are above average, right? That's how that works, right? Okay. And we're extremely humble, right? We're all those things together. So if you haven't paid already, please do so right after the lecture. We can take your money now. David Drum, you just raised his hand. It's $5. He came in after he arrived. It's $5. And any students with an ID?
Yeah.
It's $2. $2, okay. Did I miss any other first-time visitors? Did I catch all the first-time visitors? Okay. Oh, yes, sir.
You never heard my explanation.
Pardon me, my mistake. Please tell me. Please.
Jim announced that at the meeting I attended, since you were meeting.
Okay, great. Welcome. Yes. Yes, sir. Okay, fantastic. Well, we're thrilled that you guys are here. We welcome you. And we have a meetup. We mark it through meetup. We have a Facebook site. And then all of our emails. And we have a website. So I don't know if anybody's been on our website. But we have, thanks to Ken, we have a really pretty good website. If you want to become a subscriber, then we have a deal that's $35 for 6 months. Also, I want to remind everybody to pay their bill. 4 weeks ago, someone walked out inadvertently, I guess, on their check. So will that person stand up? Is there a firing squad just outside the room? So we had to pay for that, but those things will happen. But please remember to pay your bills. And usually they put the tip in, but I guess this time they didn't put the automatic tip in. They did.
They're coming back with it after you put your credit card down.
They're adding the tip after you put your credit card in there. Okay, so anyway, so you don't even add an extra tip unless it's just extraordinary service, but you don't need to do that. So we have a website that covers all these things, and please, if you enjoy this, if you feel like we bring some scintillation and excitement and energy to your life, please share it with your friends and your family members. Also, we are We're looking for a volunteer to help us with our AV needs and with social media. And so if you're interested in helping us, then we would really welcome that, because we're not real savvy in those areas. Well, Kim is with AV, but we need an assistant with Kim. So our speaker tonight will present for about 45 to 50 minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions. I mentioned to Dr. Englert that we're not shy, and we like to ask lots of questions, so we don't have real long lectures, and we have lots of room for Q&A, which seems like that works out well with the people that attend our events. And last thing, please turn off your cell phones and put them on vibrate mode at this time, and we ask you to just put them away and not do any texting this evening. We are really excited and very privileged to have Dr. Gianna Englert with us tonight. Born and raised in Pittsburgh, but a New England Patriot fan, right?
That's right.
Not a Steelers fan. She is a big New England Patriots fan because she went to school a lot in Rhode Island. And she's an assistant professor in the political science department at SMU. She was previously a doctoral research associate at the Political Theory Project at Brown University in Rhode Island. She holds a PhD in government from Georgetown University and an MA in liberal arts from St. John's College in Annapolis. Her upcoming book, Capacity for Democracy, and you're going to be talking about capacity this evening, right? Her upcoming book, Capacity for Democracy, French Liberalism and the Language of Citizenship, focuses on the concept of political capacity in the French liberal tradition. Dr. Englert will be speaking tonight on Critics of Democracy, Ancient and Modern. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Gianna Englert.
Apologies.
Can everyone hear me okay?
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. One of my colleagues at SMU, Cal Gilson, spoke really highly of this group, so I'm looking forward to this. All right, so title of the talk, Critics of Democracy, Ancient and Modern. Somebody at the table asked me, am I going to be saying anything redeeming? Not really, right? Most of these are going to be critiques, and most of these are actually going to be critiques from the history of ideas. So I said at the table, I'm not a really good philosopher. I'm really more of a historian of political thought, but I'd like to be challenged a little bit on the philosophy so we can talk about that.
You got your own? Is it on? Okay. Is it on?
Oh, I think it's just on. Green? Yep. All right, there we go. Okay, so let's talk in some ways about the dire straits we're in, or that people say we're in. So these are a few books that came out really within the last 3 or 4 years. Has anybody read any of these or seen them? There's a lot of them. Yeah, some people are nodding. Okay, so a lot of them are at Barnes & Noble, nice covers, and a lot of them preach messages of doom and gloom. So on the far side, How Democracies Die assumes that they will die, right? It's already built into the title. How? The authors of this say democracies die really from the inside out. People stop caring about the norms that support democratic government, and so they make room for autocrats, they make room for populists to kind of take hold, and it's really that the sources of democracy are within, sources of democracy's decline are within. Same with that, this Ill Winds book, which just came out, so I have not read this yet. But I think this is going to be a big deal. So Larry Diamond writes that it's really complacency for democracy that ends up eroding it. Again, this is something written within the last year. So these first two are kind of dark tales about where democracy is headed. These other two, the Orange Book and Against Democracy, those are kind of books like, Hey, I Told You So. So both of these authors, or actually all three of these authors, say things like, democracy is actually not all it's cracked up to be. They're trying to remove the romantic image from democracy itself. So in the Democracy for Realists book, they say, look, we tend to think hey, voters follow the common good. Voters are actually really tribalistic. They choose with their tribe, however their tribe looks. Yeah, okay. We got a little yes, okay. However that tribe happens to look. So they're trying to destroy the romantic image there. The Against Democracy book, I would actually, if you're going to read one of these, I would read this one, because it's the most polemic and provocative. So most places I go, people ask me, have you read this book? I have it short. And Jason Brennan in this book argues, look, voters are just ignorant. And democracy's outcomes are bad. So in the first two of these books, we're kind of bemoaning the death of something. But in these latter two, they're kind of asking, should we actually be upset if it goes away? Because democratic outcomes are really not all they're cracked up to be. So what's interesting about this, last 2 years, this is what we're facing. This is what academics are talking about. And these are really popular books. More people are focused on this question. So in the talk, I want to kind of delve into some of these assumptions, right? That democracy is dying and or that it's not that good. But rather than looking at books written just within the last 2 years, I want to look, like I said at the beginning of the talk, at the history of ideas. So what did philosophers, theorists, great thinkers from the past have to offer us in examining some of these questions? And at the end, I want to return to the question of, are these perspectives valuable? So it might be the case that I just like doing history for history's sake, and you can call me out on that. But I actually think that these history of ideas perspectives offer some kind of currency on these questions. So the two big questions I want to look at through the eyes of these critics, what are actually democracy's flaws? And the second question, even acknowledging that it has flaws, do the benefits that we get from it outweigh those flaws? Do they outweigh the problems that democracy might bear? In other words, is it the least bad solution? We're talking about this at the table. So again, the method of this, I want to look at it through the eyes of some people who I think know a lot better than me. One of them being Plato. So does anybody know what's the question that Plato begins with in the Republic? Am I allowed to ask Plato? Can I
please.
All right. What's the question of the Republic?
How shall we live?
That's one of them. What's the big one?
What is justice?
What is justice? Yeah, I don't know who said that, but that's exactly right. What is justice? And along the way, Plato says, look, if we want to figure out what justice is, we better build a just city. The most just regime, the city in speech, the Kallipolis meets the beautiful, the just fine city. And he says, okay, if I'm going to look at the just city, I better think about its opposites. I better figure out where injustice starts. And so in 375 BCE, so think about this, the fourth century BCE, Plato says, I'm going to posit something like a cycle of regimes. And for him, he thinks this cycle is inevitable. Once we start at the cycle, we're going to go the whole way through it, and then we're just going to start back up again. Now, he's not very clear on how long this takes. My students always ask me, like, where are we on the cycle? I'm not quite sure yet. We can talk about that. But he thinks the cycle is inevitable. Even if you start with justice, you're going to make your way to injustice and start the cycle all over again. So for Plato, the cycle starts with an oligarchy. Oligarchy meaning the rule of the wealthy few. So if we start with an oligarchy, Plato says, we're going to make our way to a democracy, and eventually from there we're going to make our way to tyranny. Now the really important insight of the cycle is that the problems, the downfall of each regime, starts within that government itself. It's not war, it's not invasion, it's not conquest. The reason that democracies fall, the reason that all of these regimes fall, all of these governments fall, is not because of anything outside of them, it's because of their innate characteristics. So kind of a dark place to begin, but Plato gives us a dark place to begin. So notice the way that the cycle goes. We go from the rule of the wealthy, to the rule of the many, to the rule of tyranny. So Plato's got a really interesting take on democracy. And I should say up front, one of the objections you might have, I'm happy to talk about this in the Q&A, hey, none of these guys are talking about democracy as we know it. And I think that's fair. We can discuss that. What each of them end up doing is bringing out certain features of democracy that they think are the most important. Certain features of this thing called a democratic government, and we'll see with our thinker later on, democratic society. So they're picking and choosing. And if they were writing a philosophy paper now, we would say, hey, you're kind of making a straw man. But they get to make a straw man. So Plato gets to make a straw man. And here's his analysis of democracy. So Plato says, it is probably the fairest of regimes. Now, we'll stop there. This is not fair in the sense of just. So I always tell my students, they grew up watching Disney movies, this is fair in the sense of my fair maiden. It looks good to behold. And so democracy, he says, is probably the prettiest regime. It looks good. And he says, just like a many-colored cloak, decorated in all hues, this regime, decorated with all dispositions, would also look the fairest. So we'll pause there for a second. So Plato's kind of getting at this idea that democracies are about individual choices. Under democratic regimes, there's no top-down decision about what you do and what you don't do within kind of some parameters. But Plato says, look, I look around in democracy and I can see as many choices of life as there are people. The way people decide to dress, the occupations they decide to engage in, the families they decide to have, what they decide to order to eat. Democracy is about choice, and that choice manifests in diversity. He says, just like the many-colored cloak. So hold up a jacket, there's many hues in it. Democratic life, because of its choice, gives us many hues. And we tend to think, hey, that's a great thing. I love individual choice. I love that I can choose my life plan. It's one of the great triumphs of, we now live in a liberal society. But Plato says, wait a minute. He says, perhaps like boys and women looking at many colored things, we would judge this to be fairest. Not a good, not a good image here of boys and women, right? The perception of boys and women. So I like to think of this as if you ever see somebody with kind of a very brightly colored outfit, right? Somebody trying to be very fashionable. From far away, you think, like, huh, that looks pretty good. And then the person gets closer, and you're like, wait a second. That seems to be what Plato is saying here about democratic life. From far away, the hues all together look like something that we would want. Plato, in fact, calls it a supermarket of regimes. You go in the supermarket and you choose your way of life from off the shelf. But, he says, as it gets closer, as we start to look at it, the colors kind of clash. Choice is not all it's cracked up to be. Democratic life is not all it's cracked up to be. So this image, in fact, of the many-colored cloak is supposed to point us to some of democracy's problems. So, as much as we love choice, Plato kind of hints to us, as much as we love individual freedom, too much of a good thing can be bad for you. So I love this image he gives. I'll read it and then we'll talk about it. He says, I suppose that when a democratic city, once it's thirsted for freedom, gets bad wine bearers as its leaders, and gets more drunk than it should on an unmixed draft, then unless the rulers are very gentle, it punishes them. So notice the image that we're getting here. When I teach this to my students, I can't say anything about them being drunk, but this is a different room, right? If anyone's ever had too much to drink, you know that you start to get belligerent with the person who wants you to go home and call it a night. I want to stay out. But somebody knows better than you, right? There's a good friend or somebody there is taking you home. Plato indicates here that we can get drunk on the values of democracy in the same way we get drunk on other good things. In other words, once you get a taste for freedom, it's really hard to take it away. Once you get a little bit of liberty, it's really hard to take it away. So I'm in a room now with people, my students don't remember this, but when you could just walk into the airport, you didn't have to go through all that security, right? And then we had to get used to it. Right? People railed against it when we had the Patriot Act. My students, by the way, they don't think that was true. Like, no, it was really was. Just go to the gate, you could go shopping, right? But for those of us who experience that kind of freedom, having it taken away, even for the purposes of security, was really difficult to deal with. And Plato says democracy has so much freedom, it gets drunk on it. So he says, unless their leaders are very gentle and provide the freedom, it punishes them. It says they're polluted, it says they're corrupt. Any leader who aims to restrain is immediately, they point and they say, hey, you must be one of those rich people. You must be one of those oligarchs. You must be corrupt. And so he says, who does democracy turn to? It praises and honors rulers who are like the rule. So just like the image of if you've had too much to drink, you don't listen to your reliable, rational friend in that instance. Who do you listen to? The instigator. The person who's saying what you want to hear at that moment. And Plato says democracy is a lot like that. We follow the people who say what we want to hear at that moment. The people who look like us at that moment, who we can project an image on at that moment. And so for all the discussion of choice, Plato's indicating we don't choose well because of democracy's values, notice, not because of anything outside of it, but because of what it is. So what happens, he says, democracy becomes tyranny. Too much freedom and equality becomes too much recklessness, and he actually calls it a kind of slavery. So let's think about this. What would we be enslaved to for Plato? He says, you choose your leaders poorly. You choose leaders who, instead of doing what's good for you, do what suits your fancy, do what suits your freedom at that given moment. And now we tend to call this, right? One of the things we're really worried about now, a populist, a demagogue, pick your term, an autocrat, somebody who looks a lot like us or says a lot of what we want to hear. And Plato looks and he says, look, once people get drunk on freedom, aren't they always accustomed to set up some one great man as their special leader and foster him and make him grow great? Not a very promising beginning. We're looking not for the people who know the best about the common good, not the people who are actually going to further freedom and equality according to Plato, but the people who kind of suit our fancy at the moment, who are promised to suit our fancy at the moment. So this text from the 4th century BCE gives us some insight into some of the things we're talking about right now, some of the things those first books were talking about within the last few years. Okay, so that's our one dark ancient critique. There's one more very dark ancient critique before we get to a dark critique from the modern period. So Aristotle, Plato's most famous student, follows along with his teacher, but to a degree. So we can talk about this in the Q&A. Aristotle is not as anti-democratic as Plato. He says, hey, it's not all bad. I don't have that in the talk, so feel free to ask about it. But in the Politics, which is really a book about how can the city allow people to live well, which I think was the question that somebody brought up over here. How should we live? Aristotle says politics is a guide to living well. He thinks of democracy as having a misplaced idea of what it means to live well. In fact, he says, here's the critique. Democracies begin with a really mistaken view of what justice is. And that really mistaken view extends the whole way through democratic life. So here's his critique. Okay, so this is probably a pretty familiar idea to us, actually. So Aristotle says, what do democrats think justice is? And we don't even have to go the whole way back to the 4th century BC to think about this. He says, democracy proceeds on the assumption everybody is born equal. Great assumption, right? Revolutionized the world. Being able to put that, enshrine that in principles, like the Declaration of Independence, gives us a kind of free government. But Aristotle says this principle of human equality extends outward. So what are the implications? Not only is everybody born equal, but we should be treated equally in all respects when we're allocating things. we aim for equal allocation based on innate human equality, including the principle of ruling yourself. So now we say, hey, everybody's equal, one person, one vote. And the minute we violate that, we're talking about it at the table. In 19th century England, some men got to vote three times. We think, hey, that violates the fundamental principle of human equality. That's an unjust proposal. Now when people are, we know that people are voting as their dead grandparents, right? The assumption is that violates some mandate of justice. It violates human equality. Take this guy. Yeah. Should I give it to you? I think it died. Yeah.
Is it?
It blinked and then it died.
Just tell us what we're going to ask the slide.
Okay.
There it is.
Back now? Okay.
Yeah, it's back.
Thank you. Oh, maybe that's fine. I'll just hold it very tightly. Okay. Alright. So this is democratic justice, right? A really familiar principle. The basis of, in some ways, justice as we understand it in the United States. Okay? American electoral laws. But Aristotle says, hey, there's a problem with this. What's that?
That's not what we have in the United States.
Well, it's a certain principle, right? Go ahead.
Yeah,
the
principle we have in the
sure,
United
sure.
States. Well, we have an electoral college.
Sure.
So that electoral college is unrelated to the popular vote.
Sure, that's true.
It's a republic.
But at least, right, if we were to say, well, let's imagine that tomorrow we say, hey, it's not one person, one vote anymore. It's one man, two votes, one woman, a half. We would say, wait a minute, you violated something fundamental about American life, right? You violated this. So I think you're right. We do have all of these complicated layers in the American system because you're right, it's a republic. But I think at base, if we try to violate this idea, if we tried to say three votes for me, one for you, it would violate something like this principle. Good point, though. Okay, so at least this is familiar to us, right? Familiar from the American experience. But Aristotle says, let me give you an alternative view of justice. One that might also be really familiar to us, but not in politics. So he says, let's look at what he calls distributive justice. Now, you guys are philosophers, you know, much later on, the 20th century, this has a different meaning. John Rawls is going to give it a different one. But Aristotle says, when I'm thinking about how you distribute stuff, we distribute on the basis of merit, not on the basis of equality. And so we might be looking at this like, oh, I don't know about this. But let's think about a couple examples. So here's Aristotle's example. Apparently in Athens, flutes were a hot commodity. I don't know that much about flute playing, but they're a hot commodity. So let's imagine I've got five flutes up here. Does anybody play the flute? You do. You automatically, according to the principle of distributive justice, get one flute.
I should get two.
You should get two,
yeah.
Right? And I think that's right.
I need one to practice oligarch
repertoire. Oligarch, right? She's a oligarch. So he says, yeah, I think Aristotle would say, given that no one else in here plays the flute, you should, in fact, get all five. Why? You're the only person, according to the principle of distributive justice, who can make good, meritorious uses of the flute. Mm-hmm. The rest of us just stand up here and, well, I don't even know what you do with it, right? So he says, why would I distribute things like flutes to people who can't make use of them? If I want beautiful music, I give flutes to people who can use them. Another example, teach at SMU, I think they were actually good at football. I only went to one game, but they were getting better. How do you allocate spots on the SMU football team? If SMU operated according to the principle of democratic justice, they would never win a game. Why? Everybody would decide it's on the basis of human equality that I join the football team. And we'd say, wait a second. We don't want our football team to look that way. Or why doesn't SMU have an open admissions policy? That's a great principle of democratic justice, right? Anybody who wants to come on the basis of human equality can enroll at SMU. I'm not sure I want to teach there, to be honest with you. Just people coming off the street, sitting in on classes, they don't even want to be there. They don't even really know why they're there. Another thing, I just saw this today, right? Why was the recent college admission scandal so upsetting? One, people lie and use money, right? We hate that. But also the assumption was those students involved in the college admission scandal, they didn't merit their place in the universities they got into. It struck at a fundamental principle of distributive justice. And so Aristotle's point is, in 99% of things in life, we do things on the basis of merit. College admissions, football roster slots, flutes. Why is it that political power should be any different? Why is it that I'm just handing out votes to anybody who wants one? Why isn't it the case that I apply the principle of distributive justice to politics? Why not hand out votes to the people who can use them the best? Why not say, hey, all of you here interested in philosophy, you probably read a book within the last year. That probably puts you in the top 20%. There you go. Votes. So Aristotle's point is we allocate all kinds of goods in life on the basis of merit, and only in politics do we allocate goods differently. Why should this be the case? And so he says, look, democracy begins with a fundamental flaw, that justice requires equal distribution of political power. Now somebody brought up the Electoral College earlier, right? The Electoral College and the idea of a republic kind of fits with the distributive justice point. We're still giving everybody one vote, but the idea is that we're filtering those votes on the basis of merit. We're filtering it on the basis of the people who can use it the best, who get elected to office. So as time goes on, I'm sorry.
Would you say that Wyoming and South Dakota are the same states as well?
No, I'm not defending the Electoral College up here, right? But I'm saying there's something about it that operates according to that principle. The idea that it's not purely democratic. The outcomes are not purely democratic. They're filtered through some idea of who is merited and who deserves to ultimately make political decisions. So Aristotle raises a critique for us. Why are political goods different than other kinds of goods? Okay, so a critique we might have so far, these guys are operating in a world very different from ours. So Athens at the time is a city-state with a population of about 200,000 freemen. They have a lot of slaves. Obviously, this is a small community. This is not the kind of democracy, the kind of government that we're talking about now on a large scale. They're not concerned with international things. They're not concerned with the rights of women. They're not concerned with gender, they're not concerned with race, right? It's a very different place. So maybe ancient critiques are so far removed that they don't help us. I'll return to this at the end of the talk. So let's look at a recent, fairly recent critique. I'm going to grab water. I'm on hour 4 of lecture today, so my voice is stuck. All right. So, fairly recent critique, Alexis de Tocqueville. So does anybody know anything about Tocqueville? What do we know?
French.
French, yeah, good. Tocqueville is not American. Yeah, Tocqueville is not American. Okay, what else do we know about?
He was sort of a sociologist, wasn't he?
He was an aristocrat toward America. He was an admirer of America.
Good, yeah, exactly. He's a French aristocrat who gets money from the French government in 1830 to come to America. He actually gets money to come and observe the American prison system, but he got here and he said, I don't care that much about that. There's a lot more interesting stuff going on. And exactly where he's from, an aristocratic family in France. And Tocqueville is writing and coming to America to observe democracy at a time when democracy as we know it in the modern world is really growing up and emerging. So you had, fairly recent to this, the French Revolution, which overturned the idea of aristocracy. And so Tocqueville is in Europe, and he's like, hey, I don't know if democracy is going to do well here. So I better go to a place where it seems to have lasted a little bit longer, it seems to be doing pretty well, and observe how they were able to figure things out. So interestingly, Tocqueville is modern for our sense. He's writing in an era of modern democracy, and he's coming as, in some ways, an admirer. He thinks America must have done something right because it's lasted for a while. So let's take a look at what he has to say. The book, by the way, is Democracy in America. We're talking at the table. Probably one of the best reflections on politics and on America I think ever written. So Tocqueville's got an interesting set of questions that he wants to pose. Now remember, he's interested in America because of what it can tell France. He's interested in America for what it can tell Europe. So he says, is this thing that we call democracy, is it going to survive? And he's really concerned about this. The last thing he wants is another revolution in France. Or is it the case, like he's worried about, that democracy is going to be destroyed again from the inside out? Are its own features going to take it down? So this is one of the points where we got to pause and we have to think about what does Tocqueville mean when he uses this word democracy? And he's kind of unique, right? So when we hear democracy, you probably think, oh, government, ruled by the people. And that's absolutely true. But Tocqueville says, what defines democracy here in America is not primarily a matter of who votes and who doesn't. It's not primarily a matter of politics or the way our institutions look. He says, what defines democracy in America is that it's a kind of, he calls it, the word is social state. Weird word. But we can say it's got an influence on society. So the way that our government looks, the way that our institutions look, it kind of becomes an ethical principle. It bleeds the whole way down into the way our society looks. And he defines this as it changes the relationship between individuals. You don't have aristocrats anymore leading very prominent families. You've got individuals interacting with one another in ways that express more equality than you had under aristocracy. You've got social norms that reflect egalitarian principles. You've got certain values, values of freedom and equality, that were not the primary values of aristocratic government. He says, it affects even the way that democratic citizens think. We can talk a little bit about that later if you want to. So democracy for him, it's almost everywhere. When he writes about democracy in America, people pick up the book and they think, hey, he's probably going to talk about who's voting. He's probably going to talk about Congress. He spends almost no time at all talking about those things. Maybe a little bit at the very beginning. But he talks about democracy as this social thing. And he says, given that it's social, that's where we have to look for its main problems. So he coins this term. This is Tocqueville's term. You might have heard it before, tyranny of the majority. People heard this before, yeah. So John Stuart Mill will pick it up later, but Vince Tocqueville really gives this to us. It says, the assumption here, it's not just one person who can be tyrannical. We don't have the image, that ancient image of a tyrant anymore. What we have is the image of a majority itself exercising tyranny, being tyrannical. So he says, the moral dominion of the majority is based in part on the idea that there is more enlightenment and wisdom in many than in one alone. It is the theory of equality applied to minds. So notice this, right? That idea of equality, that principle, that we saw even in the ancient context, now here informs this idea of the majority, the power of numbers. If every mind is equal, more minds together are better than just one. And think about how many American institutions rely on this principle. It's majority vote all the time. I don't know how you guys vote at the Dallas Philosophers Forum, but maybe it's majority as well. How many people want to go here? How many people want to go there? And we think, hey, It's an easy vehicle, but also the idea is if more people want it, it's probably better. It's probably showing us something that's more conducive to something like the common good. So I hate putting up a ton of text, but this quote is so good that I have to put this up here. So Tocqueville's observing this. He says, look at the power of majorities. Everything in America is a majority. I feel like when I read this, I think this could have been written last week. So he says, when a man suffers from an injustice in the United States, where do they appeal? What do they look to? To public opinion, that is what forms the majority. To the legislative body, It represents the majority and blindly obeys it. We're talking a little bit earlier, if you're running for elected office, you are in it, in some ways, a lot of people, now there are exceptions, right? In order to please the people who voted for you or the people who paid for you to be there. To the executive power, it is named by the majority and serves as a passive instrument for it. To the police are nothing other than the majority under arms. I always feel like that line could have been written the other day. Right? If there's injustice suffered you, you go to the police, who do they represent? They represent the majority already. To the jury is the majority vested with the right to deliver judgments. Judges are elected by the majority, says however iniquitous this is, however unreasonable this is, what can you do? You either appeal fruitlessly over and over again, he says, or you flee. Meaning there's really no option for you. There's very little way out. Now notice, right, how much, Stockwell's pointing to here, how much of American democracy relies on this principle? And how much of it, in fact, is just this unending circle? So Tocqueville says, look, democracy can go so far in the direction of equality. We can think, hey, more minds of equal value are better than one. The many are greater than the few. That it starts to undermine individual liberty. It starts to undermine the idea that, hey, if injustice has been done, let me find redress for it. Like Tocqueville says, where do I go? I always think this is a really profound idea. We always talk about the corruption of the justice system. And it's true, it's corrupt because of wealth, it's corrupt for all the reasons that corruption happens, but it's corrupt because it's a vehicle of majority politics. It's corrupt because it follows the norms of democracy. All right, so we've looked at three versions of critiques now, two ancient, one really modern, all hitting on different elements of this. All share the idea, though, there's something fundamental in this kind of regime that's going to bring about some problems with it. Now, only Plato was really about the doom and gloom that democracy is going to end, but they're all pointing to something fundamental, different features of the regime. So I want to turn to the question that I kind of started with. Why study history on this point? Or at least the history of ideas on this point. So these philosophers, we know, are responding to developments that happen around them. But one thing I think that's really interesting, we talked about this a little bit earlier, is that they're identifying a lot of the things that we recognize today. So Plato, when he's writing about people getting too drunk on freedom, he's really identifying what we think of as pathologies, right? The way we think or feel about something leading to a certain outcome. And he says, we feel so attached to freedom that we'll believe anybody who tells us that we can have more of it without sacrificing anything else. So all those books that we looked at earlier, they say, hey, populism's a threat, populism's a threat, we can do this, we can do that, but Plato really gets at the source of it. He says there are certain desires people have under democracies for freedom, and that leads ultimately in a destructive direction. The individual's desire for freedom leads to a rejection of any restraint, even lawful restraint. So he's getting at the fundamental kind of innate characteristics of humans that lead to some of the problems that we see in a regime built on equality. So for Plato, the seeds of populism are within democracy itself. So a little caveat or something else to think about. One of my attitudes toward this is, look, even if I can't pick up all of these critiques and put them right onto present-day politics, I don't think I can do that, right? I don't think I can take the Republic and say, hey, the Republic could speak to everything that we do today. I hope it can't. I don't want to say that. But I do think that turning to the history ideas gives us a different lens on some of these challenges that we're talking about. Rather than just looking at what are the problems here and now, what do I do to solve it here and now, these critiques kind of remind us that some of these things are persistent. Some of them are ongoing. It's not like democracy just turned bad in the last 4 years. The problems of it are latent in it. And for that reason, it might be that the solutions are kind of latent in it too, right? There's something we can do in order to rehabilitate it. So even though a lot of the things we're talking about lately, like those books I showed you in the last 2 years, A lot of the things from the past also can provide certain kinds of insights, certain kinds of directions into looking at divinity. So I'm anxious to take your questions, talk about these things, interested in what you have to say.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ebert. So we request, okay, Rob, just a second. We request you keep your statements, you know, relatively short, and then get to your question.
Okay.
Is it on?
Yeah.
I'm very impressed with the Founding Fathers and how they looked at all these issues. They, like many critics, they wanted a wise elite. They thought we could find that in the Senate, which they thought would mirror their elitist people.
Yeah.
Last year someone talked about Foucault and his view of elitist. But then the other, we don't just want wise people, we want people that will look after our individual interests.
Yeah.
And that's where the House of Representatives is. If our particular ox gets gored, that's where we want our representatives to look after our interests.
Yeah.
The third thing was the tyranny of the majority. That's where the Bill of Rights comes in. And the ACLU will say that violates the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, the 5th Amendment, and so forth. So obviously the Founding Fathers looked at all of these aspects and they tried to blend them together. I think the weakness is we don't. I don't think the Senate is necessarily, you know, a font of wisdom anymore than the House of Representatives. So.
Right. So
that's my question.
So,
yeah, what do you think?
So, So originally, right, the Senate was elected by the state legislatures. We had another mechanism of filtering elite wisdom through a different vehicle. And now that we don't do that anymore. Right. Obviously, we elect our senators. And so the Founding Fathers would have said, look, over time, a lot of these Republican barriers that we put in place have kind of been eroded. And why have they been eroded? Because people want more equality. So we've just talked about the Electoral College, right? We're getting into like heated comments on the Electoral College. Some people really resist this idea. Why? Because it's not fully democratic, like you said. It's Republican. And so I totally agree with you. I think the founders anticipated a lot of this. This is why Madison said, you know, we need to have a filtering mechanism. We need to enlarge the sphere. We need to be able to have representatives to prevent all these excesses of democracy. They were students of the ancients as well. They were students of Greece and Rome. They knew about and now all these things. But at the same time, I think if they were here now, they'd say, a lot of these protections that we put in place, not really living up to it. And one of the reasons we have separated branches is so interests can check interests. So the passions that we have at the moment aren't the ones that emerge. And now what happens? All of these different interests align. Branches don't always check other branches for the best purposes. So I think they said, hey, a lot of those safeguards, we put them there for a reason, and they're slowly fading away. Good question.
To what extent do you think we, as modern individuals, like our ancient brethren, focus on the problems before us and don't see the larger picture?
Yeah.
I mean, democracy is messy, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, and we're going through a lot of things, but we don't realize at the same time we also have women's right to vote.
Good.
Slavery, you know, being slowly but surely eliminated. We see the conflict that we experience in our arguing about these things and in the way the populace goes back and forth that these things have to flow, but not seeing that this democracy over the long haul seems to be allowing these positive things to emerge rather than maintaining a status quo that holds us in men only, you know, or white males only sort of world. To what extent do you think we're guilty of just seeing the problems before us and not seeing
it? I think that's a great question. So I think absolutely there's a lot of dark discussion about this, right? All these books coming out, Democracy Dying, this presentation as well, critics, right? Because people like to hear critiques. I think you're absolutely right. The other thing I'd add, though, Is democracy responsible for those things, or is liberalism responsible for those things? And by liberalism, I mean small L historical liberalism. The idea, right, so I put it up here as a democratic principle, but really that idea that all human beings begin with some kind of fundamental freedom, that's John Locke. John Locke was no Democrat. He was a liberal. Small L liberal. So I just ask, you know, what's really responsible for these things? Is it democracy as electoral democracy? Well, maybe, right? Or is it other principles circulating around this? Is it, in fact, the principles of the Declaration, which are really not entirely democratic? They're liberal. And so I agree with you. We have to look at a lot of the good things that this, at least the modern world, has given us. But I would just ask, where do they come from? I don't think they're entirely democratic.
And I guess the question is the democratic system, that's what it is that what allows liberalism?
Yeah.
I mean, if you have an autocratic environment, sort of, not necessarily the exact opposite, but it's sort of a, at the other pole, to what extent does liberalism get suppressed? I think it does. I agree with you completely.
Yeah.
It is that liberalism and that thought, but it's the environment in which it can
at least
survive.
Yeah, at least survive, right? So I would actually say, to go back to the question earlier, it's a Republican element where it best survives, rather than a Democratic one, or a modified Democratic one with Republican kind of features to it. Those great questions.
Question back there. So, one thing that you mentioned that Tocqueville said was that there was no place to appeal beside the majority.
Yeah.
That was not true. One could always appeal to the Constitution based in natural rights on law. So, there was a liberal base to which one could always appeal.
Okay.
But the point I wanted to focus on was consent of the governed, and could you speak to how democracy as a governing philosophy facilitates consent of the governed and acts as a sop to the populace?
Good. What was the last part of the question? Acts as
a sop.
Oh, for the populace. Okay. All right. So okay, a couple things. I'll respond to the Tocqueville one later if we've got time. So the first one, the principle of consent of the governed. Going back to what we were just discussing here, consent of the governed is originally, again, not a democratic principle. Where does it come from? And you know this based on your question, right? Actually, it comes from Thomas Hobbes. Furthest thing from a Democrat, or people around Hobbes, furthest thing from a Democrat that we could get. Hobbes said, if you want good government to work, you put up an autocratic, absolutist sovereign in the middle of everything. And everybody would consent to follow that person. So consent doesn't necessarily lead in a democratic direction, right? All that consent requires, even for John Locke, is that our government be proving itself legitimate. And he says, what is a legitimate government? It's circular. It's a government we've consented to. Now, I can see what you're saying here. Doesn't democracy require that I give my consent every so often when I go to the polls? But what if my candidate doesn't win? Have I still consented?
Yes.
Why? What have I consented to?
You participated in the choosing process, and you convinced yourself
you
have a voice.
I've convinced myself I have a voice. Good. So in some ways, democracy perpetuates a fiction of consent. Exactly. It keeps people in line with a fiction of consent. Hey, every day I push this. But unless anybody, has anybody taken a citizenship oath? You have. You have actually consented. None of us have really consented. Nobody ever sat me down and said, hey, what do you think about consenting to the American regime? I don't know. Has anybody ever been asked that? I have not been. You actually have consented, however.
I was in the Army.
Okay, so you have actually done it. But none of us really have, right? And so I do like this idea that voting gives us the fiction of consent that we're part of this thing, but that we know that the government that I might choose is legitimate, the candidate I might choose is legitimate, might very easily lose. Again, what am I consenting to? So I do like this idea that it gives me an outlet for that kind of thing. Yes, sir.
What do you see as the role of the unlimited corporate campaign spending that the Citizens United decision opened up in these theories of democracy? One of Tocqueville's assumptions was the legislature would represent the majority.
Yep.
I think you could argue the legislature represents their corporate donors these days.
Good. That's a great question, right? So what did Tocqueville not foresee? A tyrannical minority based on wealth. In fact, I said he didn't really foresee that. He actually did in the book. He said, hey, I think we're getting what he called an industrial aristocracy. He didn't really have a good word for it, but he said, what I'm seeing are basically people who have a lot of money and want to wield it in terms of exercising political power. So I think this is a really good, who said that? I'm sorry. Oh, no, no, go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead, yeah. I'm sorry, I thought you were adding something. I think Tocqueville saw the beginnings of this, but didn't think it was that much of a threat. At the same time, though, I do like this idea, right, that for him, democracy was not simply about power in institutions. So we're speaking about power in institutions. Where does the money go? And I think this is that's obviously a huge issue. How do interest groups influence outcomes? But Tocqueville was also really interested in democracy as a social thing. Tyranny of the majority being a pervasive kind of influence. The way that it even influences, and I really think the policing line is really important there. It's not just the major national institutions that are influenced by democracy. It's even local kinds of things and social norms that are influenced by it.
Okay, so I want to put you on the spot here, Dr. Engler. A great speech, great presentation. So you are a professional political scientist. You are studying democracy.
Yep.
So let's say you're Queen Gianna for the day.
Okay.
And you get to make any change you can to our democracy, some weakness of our democracy, you would change today. What would that be?
I would change the influence of money in politics.
And how would you do that?
That's a great question. I'm not a really good political scientist here. I actually don't know how I would do it. But I think there's got to be, what are laws that are passed now? They're really the influence of interest groups. Interest groups with the loudest voice and with the biggest purse. I mean, that's what American democracy has become. It has not become meritocratic, right? So the alternative here was, for Aristotle, democracy or meritocracy. It's not, we're not making that choice anymore, right? We're kind of getting neither thing. We're neither getting equality nor merit. So that's what I would want to change, yeah?
Democracy in Plato and Aristotle's time, what they saw was that men who wanted to be elected to office would offer more goodies, promise
exactly
more goodies, take money from the rich, give to the poor, bread, divide up the land, whatever. So, and this, led to demagoguery and then to ultimate, tyranny. And that was their cycle. It seems to me that, as we get to more mass democracy, we're getting into demagoguery and, buying elections and that sort of thing, too. And it seems to me in the past, since Roosevelt time, the executive branch has gotten to be more and more and more powerful over the legislature. Congress was supposed to have most of the power.
Yeah.
Do you see, what's effectively a four-year monarchy that we elect? The executive branch has just got so powerful that we're getting into this tyranny of the majority?
That's a good question. So it goes back to one of the comments over here about the founders, right? So you're exactly right. People always say, oh, the founders feared a king. That's absolutely untrue. The founders thought that all the power would come from the legislature. They thought, oh, we've dealt with the problem of kingship. Now your question brings up rather whether they really did, right? And one of the responses to it is, I think that all of the system that they came up with, checks and balances, partial agency, that's been eroded for other reasons. And part of it is this idea of interests. Part of it is the emergence of the party system. People are aligning in different ways now that the founders didn't foresee. So I don't know if the problem is actually the design of the office itself, the fact that it's like this four-year monarchy, or if it's other things in American politics. I think the party system has a lot to do with it, right? Who is going to check the president? We've seen not members of his own party. And it doesn't even matter who the president is, right? I think this is universally true now. Members of a party are generally not going to stand up to that, to the executive. So that's a great question. But I think it's the result of other phenomena in American politics, yes.
I think much of what liberalism attempted to do is try to
to stabilize the system that Plato had identified to eliminate the worst of all three of those different systems.
Yeah.
But when our country was set up, the general system assumed that there would be a lot of different groups competing with each other. And what has largely happened now is there aren't a lot of different groups competing with each other. We're tribalizing into basically a couple of groups, or maybe three groups. But what do you think has caused the breakdown of that so that there are not a lot of different groups competing with each other, but just a small number?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. The founders thought, if we're going to have these things, they call them factions. If we're going to have factions, we should have a lot of them. Because the more you have, the less likely it's going to be that one can take power. So I think there's a couple different things, reasons for the erosion of faction. Again, I'm a bad social scientist, so I don't have data, but I think one is like the erosion of civil society generally. So if you guys meet here every 2 weeks, that's civil society. Nobody forces you here. The law forces you here. You're here because you're interested in philosophy. There are not that many groups like this that are regular like this now, right? In the 90s, Putnam had this book, Bowling Alone. It was an image of bowling alleys with nobody in them. Remember that book? Because bowling alleys, nobody's in them. Why is nobody in them? Because nobody's part of groups anymore. And Putnam says, people stay home and watch TV, and now we watch Netflix and go on the internet. So I think that's one thing. There are not as many groups now. Interestingly, Tocqueville worried about the exact same thing. People don't get outside of themselves anymore. They don't join factions, they don't join groups. The other thing I think, the reason for the coalescing into a few groups is the party system in the United States. So the founders thought, we're going to join different groups that cut across our different allegiances, right? So I'm a woman, I might join a woman's group, I might join a Democrats group, and then I might join the Knitters Club or something. The founders thought, you can be a part of all of that. But now it's sort of like, pick your poison. You're either with us or against us. You've got this kind of rhetoric throughout American politics. So you belong to one thing or you don't belong anywhere. I think that those two things together, I think, have contributed to exactly what you're pointing to.
So you've got this recent phenomenon that none of these people spoke to because it didn't exist in their day, and that's the increasing influence of unregulated social media. And I wonder if that's caused a phase change in our ability to govern ourselves.
Yeah, so people are studying this a lot right now, right? Whether social media helps or hinders democracy. So in some instances, like in the Arab Spring, for example, the revolutions in the Arab world that happened, I guess it was 7 or 8 years ago, people used social media to coordinate, to get out there and actually be part of the revolution. They were trying to bring about democratic reforms through social media. But now, I kind of see what you mean in terms of it being unregulated. One thing I'll say is I think it contributes in part to that erosion of civil society that I've talked about before. So Tocqueville kind of warned us, hey, when people start sitting at home, just staying in their own little world, they're not getting out and doing anything else. They're not doing anything useful for the common good. They're not thinking about politics that much. Social media only contributes to that staying at home. I have to tell my students every day, put the phone away during a lecture. If you can't put the phone down for 50 minutes, that's not good, right? But they're all glued. They all are checking it. They're all glued to it. Why? Because they're kind of, it's individualistic. They're really wrapped up in what's happening there and not what's happening here. So I think it's actually more, it's less of kind of like a direct institutional answer to your question, but I think there's a problem with this. Yeah, definitely.
Question back here, Dr. Yee.
So one thing that kind of puzzles me about the whole critics of democracy is, and I'm sure this was just as much of an issue when the country was being started and we were implementing this legislative or representative type of democracy rather than a true democracy where everybody votes on everything.
Mm-hmm.
So we send these representatives and they're supposed to represent us even though they're really not checking in with constituents a lot these days, it seems like. But what it seems like religion was just as big a part of what was going on at the time of the founding as it is now, but now it seems like it's really becoming a divisive issue rather than something people hold personally, and now it's being put into politics, and it seemed like the founding fathers were pretty adamant of keeping that separate, and now it's starting to clash, and I don't know how much that's going to change democracy.
Yeah, so this is a good question. So this, and it's also really complicated. So I think you're right. The founders wanted to keep religion out of policy and law. But I think they relied on religion as giving fundamental values that we were supposed to draw on in thinking about what was American. So if you read George Washington's farewell address, for example, George Washington talks about religion being a spring of morality. Imagine this, right? Somebody's leaving the presidency, and they're saying, our morals come from religion. If we said this now, everybody would be like, oh my, you can't say that. So kind of what you're getting at now. So they didn't want our policy decisions to be influenced by one sect over another, but they thought, hey, you got to have some common values to draw on. And this kind of gets at a point here that we didn't really talk about too much, though it's behind some of the questions. What does democracy require in terms of the values that we share? So maybe one of the common problems here is there's not enough overlap, right? If it's everybody out for themselves, if it's everybody out for their own interests, if we're not sure what we're looking for, of course we're going to get these problems. But the founders thought, hey, you need like a common stock to draw on. And I think religion was part of that.
Mm-hmm. Question here.
I think there's one there too.
Yeah,
sorry.
So, two things. One, the gentleman making a point about the progression of governance and how we've basically delegated all the legislative authority to the executive branch.
Yeah.
That occurred with the implementation of the bureaucratic state,
yeah,
when Congress literally granted the authority to make law to the president.
Yeah.
Clear violation of the Constitution, but it was not stopped by the Supreme Court. But getting back to the point of polarization into two parties, could that not possibly, and this is what I'd like to expound upon, be related to the fundamental schism of humanity between the individual and the collective group? Because those are the two vanishing points to which human psychology approaches, and they reflect the two parties, although not permanently.
Right, yeah. So I think there's a point to be made. Maybe they originally reflected the two parties. But now, if you said, which party is for the individual, which is for the collective, I'd say, oh, wait, I got to think of it. And around all the different axes, I feel like I could draw different arguments there. So I think there is a good psychological argument to be made for it. Maybe an argument then is, hey, we've fallen into these paths. If you are a Democrat, right, you think that the Democratic Party is what you started with when you joined the Democratic Party, but it looks really different now. Mm-hmm. You think the Republican Party is what it was when I joined the Republican Party, but it's really different now. So I don't even know that I could identify, I could put all different issues on different sides, but I don't even think I could place them on either pole. But I think that's a good observation.
Question.
Yes. You spoke a couple of questions ago about civil society.
Yes.
And talking to your students that this individualization is just not part of civil society. Can you give a thought or tell, is there a thought you might have, when in our world was there ever a civil society?
Good. Yeah, okay.
That worked, and what kind of government was there associated with?
So that's good. So by civil society here, I meant the kind of associations that you have that you join because you want to be here. This is a perfect example of civil society here. Right? There's no force behind it. There's no compulsion behind it. No law says you show up Tuesday at 6:30. So you're here to be part of this thing that we call, it's not quite government, it's not your family, it's in between. And so the question is, you know, when did we have this? So I think we tend to romanticize this idea like, oh, we belong to all these groups. But Tocqueville does write, when he came here in the 19th century, he saw Americans belonging to everything. He said, people join with other people in order to help them fix their house. People join with other people in order to be a part of groups about things they're interested in. Right? So he says, what I saw in America at the time was people getting out of their own bubble, overlapping on interests. It served a purpose like religion did. It kind of gave you something common to start with. You went out and you met people unlike yourself, but who shared something along with you. Right? So by civil society here, I don't think we've ever had a civil society. Not really. Not really. I think that's how you're using it, right? Not really. But Tocqueville said, hey, at least on certain issues, we were overlapping more than we are now. And what else does social media do? So I'll just get on the social media soapbox now. It allows you to be polemical behind a screen. everybody's families are arguing, right? Well, the cousin I have not seen in 10 years now came out of the woodwork to have some argument with me on social media. But there's a lot of anonymity there, and it's less civil than I think even the reality of an uncivil place was. Yeah.
We have time for two more questions, and this is the second to the last question.
I'll be quick at my answer.
As I heard some of your critiques, I was just kind of thinking of something that came to mind that you could clarify.
Yeah.
So Plato's critique, for instance, was that democracy from the state level would overflow into other kinds of regimes by virtue of its own nature.
Yeah.
But isn't that also then a critique of aristocracy and tyranny?
Yeah.
And therefore, maybe democracy isn't, maybe that isn't really a criticism of democracy, but it was a criticism of politics.
Yeah, good. Should I answer that one first?
Well, one is, if I remember correctly, Aristotle's critique was that it would be better to have something where we distribute on merit, and we should do that in politics. What did he have to say about, if we didn't do that in politics, if we could have some institutions in maybe private life that aren't political institutions, but that still carry out that role, but that was compatible? I mean, I guess that's sort of what we do in the U.S.
Yeah. So let me answer the first one first. So I really like this observation. I think it's absolutely right. That the problem is, anytime people get together, there's going to be some causes that cause that thing to fall down, whatever it is. I think he would completely agree with you. But he would say, it's a question of what's doing the falling down. It's like a question of what's imploding the thing. So he says, hey, the reason that oligarchy implodes is that the people who don't have anything start to resent the people who have too much. So that's its own reason. So the reasons that I've given here, democracy kind of romanticizing choice, he would say that's a distinctly democratic cause. But I think he'd completely agree with you. It's politics that's really the problem. Anytime people get together, it's going to be unstable. Things aren't going to last forever, which is an interesting point, right? We're in the West in the midst of a democratic regime. If Plato is right, is it going to last forever? Not really. So to the Aristotle point, he'd say, yeah, we do it all the time in other things, but he thinks, hey, merit in politics should be extended in the exact same way.
Any last question? Anyone? Oh, back here. Last question. We love our questions.
One quick one about rebellion and then how that impacts democracy.
Yeah.
So it seems like we've always seen it as something really dysfunctional, and that needs to be put down as quickly as possible, whether it's Occupy Wall Street or labor issues, you know, back in the 20s, or, you know, there's just been things all the time. And how, you know, is it a protection of democracy, or is it something that should be allowed to happen so people can express really the issues they feel like they're being suppressed by?
Yeah, that's a good question. So is it a feature or is it a bug? Does it ruin the system or do we need it? I actually think that we need it. So that's not an excuse for outright violence, right? But it is a discussion of kind of peaceful protest. And I think we are seeing more and more of them. And I think that is an example, again, that's a civil society coming back. People actually now care so much about so many diverse issues, people take the day off of work and go for a protest or something like that. Right? I mean, that actually says something.
Okay, so let's give another round of applause.